Lated. And often as not, they'll wheel an aluminum coffin into the ward to take out the person who has most recently died. Last week I visited three hospices in Zambia, one in Lusaka. I went up to the Copper Belt and visited a hospice in the city of Ndola. I visited a hospice outside Lusaka. And the hospices, they're all 20 or 25 bed hospices. Virtually every single person in the bed, the majority of them are women, are dying. And you stand in the midst of it and you know as you're standing there that they don't have to die. That if we were able to get the medication to them, their lives would be prolonged by 10, 15, or 20 years in many instances. Certainly for several years at least. Everybody is apoplectic and traumatized and reeling as a consequence of the numbers of orphans. The way you deal with the orphan problem is to keep the parents alive. It's the simplest formula in the world. And I look around the room and you walk from bed to bed and you clutch the hand of somebody who embraces you so feebly that it's unnerving, and you wipe a brow, you say a friendly word, thinking of what banality am I now capable? And you know all these people are not going to make it. And there's no reason for their not making it. That if the world reacted with a sense of emergency to the Holocaust around AIDS in Africa, with the way in which we reacted to the devastating human consequences of the tsunami, then we would save millions upon millions of lives. And I don't entirely understand. I don't entirely understand why the world cannot and has not yet rallied. There are glimpses of hope around treatment and resources and prevention and energy, but it moves so slowly, so incrementally. You lose so many people along the way, and mostly you're losing women. Can I just please add that as a reality? I've been a feminist all my adult life. I believe in the feminist analysis of the exercise of male power and authority. I've never seen it more applicable than is the case in Africa and other parts of the world now. But women represent such a disproportionate number of infections. They are physiologically and culturally so much more vulnerable. They are often in the age group from 15 to 24 infected at a level that is 5 and 6 times higher than young men and boys in that age group. Young women have no opportunity to say no, to say wear a condom, to negotiate safe sex. As a matter of fact, one of the most startling revelations that has emerged from a number of recent studies, which we should have foreseen and didn't foresee, was that one of the riskiest environments for women, certainly in Africa now, is to be married. Because the prevalence rates in marriage are higher than the prevalence rates of single sexually active women in the community. Because young women marry older men bring the virus into the marriage. No young woman can say to her husband, wear a condom. You can't use abstinence, it's neither desirable nor possible, and fidelity has to be assumed. So you end up with this startling phenomenon of women showing highest rates of prevalence when they are married. And then when you have an absence of a legislative framework around property rights and inheritance rights and around sexual violence and around generally protecting and empowering women, you have the depopulation of parts of your continent of its women, and women do all the work. They are the caregivers. They carry the entire burden of care. The husband gets infected or the partner gets infected in the city, he comes back to the rural villages to die. And the partner, the woman, looks after him. She looks after the others who are sick. She looks after herself when she gets sick. She looks after the orphans. There are 13 million orphans now in sub-Saharan Africa. expected to rise to 20 million by 2010. These millions of kids wandering the landscape of the continent, confused, bewildered, angry, forlorn, seeking nurture and love, like any child you've ever seen, you want to scoop them all up in your arms and run off with them. And they don't become orphans when their parents die. They become orphans while their parents are dying. I cannot tell you how many little villages I've been taken to by people who do home-based care, who look after those who are ill. And they take you down the dustiest trails into the far hinterland, and you enter a hut. It's always the same. The mother is lying on a mat. The father has died. The mother is so weak she cannot raise her head to acknowledge the entry of a visitor. You bend down, you try to say something comforting, you look around you, and you suddenly realize that her children are standing in the hut watching her die. I don't know how you summon a degree of emotional equanimity at the end of that experience as you grow up into a full-grown adult. And the sense of these kids trying to cope, the community tries desperately to absorb them through surrogate families and through foster relationships, but the communities are tremendously poor, and although they are enormously adept, extra mouths frequently push them over the edge. There are orphanages which spring up, but orphanages are never quite the answer for reasons which everyone in this room can intuit, because the capacity to feel familial and to share love and nurture sufficiently is often very difficult in an orphanage environment. You want youngsters to have some sense of family. You know what's happening on the African continent, at least, and increasingly in India and China. The heroes of the continent are grandmothers. You violate all of the normal rhythms of life. The grandmothers bury their own children, and then they look after their orphan grandchildren. They are so lovely. They are trying so hard. When I was in Malawi, I was in a little orphan setting, and I entered a room called Canada House because CEDA had spent some of the money to build it. And I met with 75 grandmothers. And they danced and they sang, as they always do with a visitor, and then they poured out their hearts. They didn't have food. They didn't have an aspirin for an opportunistic infection. They didn't have any money to buy anything for the kids. They couldn't afford the school fees for the children. And our exchange was over. They started singing and dancing again. I went down into the crowd, and I took a 73-year-old woman in my arms, and we did a little pirouette, much to the amusement of everybody who was watching. And I said to her, "You're looking after orphan children?" She said, "Yes." I said, "How many kids do you look after?" She says, "I'm looking after 13 children between the ages of 2 and 16. And that pattern is repeated right across the continent. And then when the grandmothers die, there's no one coming up behind. So you end up with this bizarre phenomenon of child-headed households, where the oldest sibling in the family looks after the younger siblings. You have child-headed households in Swaziland, headed by children of the age of 8. Many such households. And to watch 9, 10, 11, 12-year-olds desperately attempting to keep the formation of a family together is something that is absolutely beyond most human experience. You see, we've never confronted anything like this before. Africa is an extraordinarily generous and sophisticated continent. At the grassroots, particularly under the women, there is such generosity and understanding and knowledge and capacity. It should never be underestimated. And the continent can pull itself out from the abyss. The continent can break the back of the pandemic. All it needs is a sense of emergency from the rest of the world. Because believe me, that sense of emergency now grips the continent. Everywhere you go, you people are fighting for survival, and they know it. I meet with the president of Botswana. He uses the word extermination when he describes what they're facing if they don't overcome it. When I meet with the prime minister of Lesotho, he uses the word annihilation to describe what he's facing if they don't overcome it. These are no longer societies that are in any sense in denial or silence. But what they need is a rallied sense of emergency from the rest of the world. And that, I assume, will not be long in coming. Do librarians have a role? Is this simply a highly particularized and specialized form? No, not at all. I think, if I may be so bold, is that on the continent, amongst the schools, there is a desperate need for books. Books of every imaginable kind, so long as they are of good quality. And the possibilities of librarians facilitating the shipment of large numbers of books, or engaging in organizations that do ship books to Africa or to India, the kind of thing which will animate a child's life forever and maybe change that life, that's something which librarians can do and organize as no other group can do. And then for people who want to be otherwise engaged, the support for the big non-governmental organizations like CARE and PLAN and Save the Children and World Vision and UNICEF and Oxfam and Doctors Without Borders. And there's a whole plethora of foundations. I even have a little foundation myself. There are loads of them that actually do serious, good work at the grassroots, community, village level, transforming the lives people lead. You can't imagine. A few thousand dollars is like a cornucopia to these communities. And maybe there's even the possibility of twinning, because there are lots of primary schools where in the urban centers they do a little email. They can be in touch with children here. They value books and literature stupendously. It would be an enormous contribution. Look at the way we responded to the tsunami. But it is only one crisis of a world replete with human crises. And without stretching things too far, I think it's fair to say that somewhere along the way in the last number of years, international society lost its moral anchor. We became more consumed with conflict than we became consumed with the human condition. And that must be reversed. And this is a good country to start with a government which up till now has shown a willingness to get engaged and therefore respond to pressure. And I beg you to consider those things, because you're a lovely, generous, and culturally alive profession, and you can make a profound collective difference in this world. Thank you for having me. Stephen, as you can tell, the introduction was not hyperbole, it was understatement, very definitely. And you can also tell that you were not so much a replacement as much as the voice that so many people here needed and wanted to hear. We will have to make sure that you come back. We'll make sure that you come back far more frequently than once every 15 years, because we need to have that voice. I do know that if, in fact, the province of Ontario had been composed completely of librarians, you would have been an elected official. But an elected government. But I'm not sure that would have been a good thing for Canada or for the world, because as much as I respected you as a politician, I think you make a far better conscience than you do a politician. I appreciate your comments enormously. Thank you, everyone. That was superb.